Welcome to December in South Dakota, and welcome to a December like no other. We've endured nearly a year of pandemic, disruption, and anxiety. We've lost loved ones, more than 1,000 loved ones so far. On many days, it felt as if we had lost our way. On this In the Moment podcast, we're going to reevaluate how we think and communicate about our mortality, our loneliness, and our holiday gatherings. It's not as bleak a conversation as you might think. In the conversations you're about to hear, we offer knowledge, validation, curiosity, creativity. We've got guests who might make you feel a little less alone and tips for navigating this month together. We begin with Sabina Cooper-Schmidt. She is chair of the Interprofessional Health Education Center at the University of South Dakota and project director of a statewide program working with healthcare professionals. It's called Palliative Care Quality Conversations. She's leading an effort to help families have better conversations around end-of-life care. Sabina Cooper-Schmidt, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Let's talk about what palliative care is and what it isn't at first, just to ground people who haven't heard of this or are confused about it. How do you define it?
Palliative care is really, for our purposes, we define it as an interprofessional approach to healthcare that focuses on improving the quality of life and reducing suffering of patients who are faced with serious illnesses, and also includes their caretakers and often family members and loved ones.
I want to jump in because I really want to make sure we have time to ask you how some of these conversations are changing in the time of COVID, when people are worried about hospital capacity, or you can't gather around the table like we did, you know, in the before times, or when somebody is, you know, the decisions that they might have made are now different because of COVID-19, and that they might change their mind, you know, weekly. There was lots of people when this started, they said, absolutely, I don't want to be on a ventilator, and now maybe they've changed their minds as the success rate is different. So my question to you, Dr. Cooper-Schmidt, is, you know, how have these conversations shifted during the pandemic?
So I can't tell you from my personal experience, because I'm not a clinician any longer. I'm in academic nursing. So I really haven't had the resources. I haven't had to talk to patients. However, our coalition that we have generated is making these resources available for caretakers. So this is really our initiative at USD. We have brought together a coalition that we're calling Palliative Care, Supporting Healthcare Decision Making. And this is a coalition of clinicians and even anybody who might be interested in participating. Like I said, if it's the mailman or if it's the receptionist at an office, at a doctor's office, who has noticed that a patient is not coming in, So we have received funding for a project there that educates the personnel who are involved in helping people in rural areas to define what their plan for palliative care should be, or how to help others who are involved in caring for palliative care patients. So this is actually my role in bringing together this statewide coalition of palliative care workers.
You know, how important is it to have these family conversations now, especially in a time when we're all kind of considering hospitalization and mortality in new ways?
So to talk about the family, I think these family get-togethers that everybody is hopefully entering into, whether it should be through distant platforms or in person, are actually very useful. You should have a conversation, especially if you are immunosuppressed or in the risky classes of people. You should have a conversation with your what we are calling a proxy, a healthcare proxy, the person who is informed. And that could be anybody. That could be your spouse. It could be a child. It could be a distant relative. It could be a loved one. It could be a friend.
Almost since the beginning of the pandemic, the phrase social distancing has been promoted and embraced and challenged. Jill Tyler is an associate professor and chair of communication studies at the University of South Dakota. She recently served on a panel of USD scholars called Boundless Intersections. It looked at COVID-19 through the lens of a variety of disciplines. You can find the full conversation on the USD Facebook page. She joined us to talk about what we know about loneliness now, who it impacts, and how we can reach toward a greater connectivity through communication and empathy. Professor Tyler, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Great. Thanks so much, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Since this pandemic began, we have been talking with healthcare professionals week by week and asking them, what do we know about this virus that we didn't know last week? Because the information has been changing. The science has been emerging so rapidly. Is it a similar situation with what we are learning about things like isolation and loneliness?
It is somewhat. We don't have a lot of long-term numbers as far as what social isolation and loneliness, how much of the social isolation and loneliness we had 9 months ago or even 5 to 10 years ago. But the general feeling among people who are studying loneliness are saying, yes, it has certainly elevated. To make a distinction, loneliness is all of us have felt lonely at some time in our lives, but loneliness is that feeling. It's an emotional response when we perceive that we are alone. So we can feel lonely when we're around others, and just as we can sometimes appreciate the solitude of being alone. But loneliness has much more to do with our feelings of connection and our feelings of being valued, our feelings of belonging. So in 2018, there was a major study done across the country, and at that time, 22% of adults in the U.S. reported that they were often or frequently feeling lonely. And that's about 55 million people, so that's a lot. And that, as I said, that was 22%. More recently, early in September, that study was repeated, and it came back with between 40 and 48% of adults in America report that they have felt lonely or that they often or always feel lonely.
Yeah. This phrase of social distancing came up pretty early, and many people were saying, boy, I wish we hadn't called it that, but it kind of stuck. How is that social distancing affecting our feelings of loneliness?
Well, we know that our feelings of loneliness have increased since midsummer. We have both in terms of greater numbers of people who report feeling lonely and in terms of more intense feelings. And so that separation from others has really been, even when our cognitive side of our being says, this is the right thing to do, this is a safe way to be, that we still have a really very human need to be connected to other people. And you've heard people even say things like, let's do it via Zoom because I like being able to see your face. And when we're together, I can only see your mask. And hearing one another's voices is another element that people have said. I emails are great and I like hearing from you, but hearing your voice is really wonderful. We've known for a long time that our physical, our mental, our emotional health are really highly correlated with the strength of our social circles. So friends and families and coworkers and communities. And most of the time we think about that in terms of our our intimate groups, our friends, family, coworkers. But what's missing now is what some sociologists call a third space. So if our first space is home and our second space is our work, our third space is the place in our lives that is not home and not work, but it's the coffee shops and the co-op, the civic organizations, the churches. So those are very powerful ways that we link ourselves to our communities. And those are some of the, that's what's missing in our connections now is that third space. So even when we have, you know, somewhat regular connection with family, we still feel a distance from those folks who we were pretty used to spending time with.
From what you're saying, I guess one of my takeaways would be choose wisely, because these people that you're connected with and the way you connect has a great impact on your behavior and on your physical health.
Yes, it really does. There are a lot of really strong connections between loneliness and our physical health. They are correlations, you know, that they're not necessarily causal, but many researchers trace this back through an evolutionary perspective and talk about how thousands of years ago, we as humans needed our tribes. We needed to live together because we couldn't, you know, have enough food and enough safety. We needed other people. And that when we were without other people thousands of years ago, we would be in greater stress. We would have, we would be hypervigilant. Our bodies would experience stress. And that is that living in a state of threat causes us to has really, you know, negative physical impacts. It impairs our immune responses and raises our heart rate, raises levels of inflammation, which can then lead to cardiovascular problems, to sleep disturbances. And this is, I think, one of the really tough parts, is that living in this state of threat actually causes us to doubt ourselves. So our self-confidence diminishes a bit. We begin to doubt our worth and our value. And we kind of come to a point where we don't believe that anyone wants to be with us. So that's one of the really tragic dimensions. It is often a part of that social isolation and loneliness.
Yeah. Who is most impacted by loneliness? What do we know about that?
Well, traditionally, it has been older adults, which I think right here in South Dakota, we see that older adults in rural areas, they're retired or out of the workforce. They're frequently isolated, maybe, you know, still on the farm. But as I said, they're missing that third space. But in the most recent study, the group of 65 and older was surpassed by the group 18 to 30, which was a real surprise to so many of us. But when we think about it, okay, these are students, kids leaving home, they're leaving jobs, they're leaving colleges, they're getting married, they're moving, and they're really developing really vital social and personal connections. And now I can talk a little bit more in my area of study from a communication skills perspective. This group demonstrates a few unexpected deficits. For example, they're less accurate in reading facial expressions, and they sometimes have trouble keeping a conversation going. So we call it nexting, N-E-X-T-I-N-G. That is giving your conversational partner something to respond to, which you know how to do very well. But these are skills that are developed and practiced in those third spaces, right, with people who we don't have really strong ties to. And over the last generation, our tendency to stay at home, our technology has kept us off the phone and really minimizes some of those kind of everyday, mundane interactions with people at the grocery store and the bookstore, where we practice those conversational skills. So I trace that back from a communication perspective. I trace that. That helps me explain some of the increased loneliness that is being experienced by that I call them younger generation.
So here's for any parent who's listening, or person in that demographic listening, who's wondering, like, what are the long-term impacts of this? Then this is already, you know, a group of people who might be challenged from a communication skills standpoint, and now the opportunity to improve with that is really being taken away for a certain period of time. Could this impact careers and parenting and marriage? And I mean, like, how vast of a ripple can that potentially be?
Well, I mean, we are talking about huge numbers of people. We know that loneliness is far more common than we probably thought. But I hope that the pandemic has actually exacerbated social isolation and loneliness, but it's also shown a light on a problem that has probably been around for quite a while, and that really can be addressed with really small steps. It may result in a very fundamental change in our priorities and how we spend our time, but the steps that we would be taking would be very small, you know, really just doing things like, I don't want to advise anyone to give up their technology, because the technology, actually, we do have evidence that it's a pretty effective substitute for face-to-face interaction, especially in times of social isolation.
What are some of the things that we can do to alleviate loneliness, especially as we look at a month like December?
Well, I'm going to, first of all, make it a point to say, respond. The lonely people, I always grimace when somebody says something, oh, if you're lonely, reach out. That's very hard for a lonely person to do. So it needs to be us. We're more aware of people who we can reach out. And then the main advice I give is, don't say, okay, we're just not going to have our holiday celebration this year. Say instead, this is how we're going to have our holiday celebration. So if you always have a big breakfast on a holiday morning, have the big breakfast, but everyone fixes it at their own home, and that's when you do your Zoom call or your FaceTiming. And other than that, really very small steps can make a big difference. Communicating that people are valued and appreciated. We have a chance to coordinate, to call. You know, let's make sure that she gets called every day. So you don't have to call every day, but over the seven of us, we'll make sure that she gets called every day. Plan a regular lunch or coffee time every week. Engage in mental activities. Try to get outside as much as possible. And really coordinate those frequent and consistent interactions with others.
Priya Parker is the author of the book, The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. She's the founder of Thrive Labs and creator of the New York Times podcast, Together Apart, which she says should be considered a public health podcast. She has deep roots in South Dakota, and she joined us with insight on why we're struggling so much with the holidays this year. And once you understand what it is we most need, how you can create clarity with why and how we gather. What the heck do we do now is my question to you. We have to start by redefining how we even think at this point, right?
Absolutely. I mean, so, you know, I'm a conflict resolution facilitator, which basically means that I work with groups who are in some amount of conflict about their vision, their identity, how to do things, and how to create a meaningful experience where they actually are able to come to terms with each other and some kind of way forward. And in The Art of Gathering, I have a concept that I call generous authority. And generous authority basically means, well, let me step back for a second. So I define a gathering as any time three or more people come together for a purpose with a beginning, middle, or end. So a wedding, a funeral, a barbecue, a neighborhood barbecue, a Zoom meeting, a Zoom staff meeting, a family reunion. And one of the mistakes we make well before COVID in our gatherings is that we tend, particularly with our informal gatherings, to underhost, in part to not want to impose on each other, in part to not want to seem pushy. We tend to just kind of let people be. And one, and part of the myth of the idea that we're leaving people alone is we're not actually leaving them alone. We're leaving them to each other, right? We're leaving our guests to deal with each other. And at some level, and I know different states have different governors and different restrictions, but one of the things that when governors are not sort of setting out specific restrictions, specific gathering guidelines, is that she's leaving you to each other, right? Meaning different people have different norms and perceptions of both the virus and how it spreads, but also perceptions of levels of risk. And so part of what families are dealing with all over the country, but particularly in states like South Dakota, you know, I don't know if you know this, but I actually have a very deep connection to South Dakota. My grandmother's entire family is from South Dakota. My grandmother was born and raised in Wagner. Part of what the state is dealing with right now is that when a host in the form of a governor does not assert her authority to kind of create guidelines that protect the whole, the WHOLE, it leaves the guests, the citizens, to have to deal with each other. And particularly in families and friend groups that care about each other, part of that looks like much more explicit conversation than we normally would have to do something as simple as a play date.
That resonates, I think, with a lot of people right now.
So, and this is relating to friends. It's related to families. It's related to parents who have young children who are trying to figure out, you know, do you share childcare? You know, do I send my kids to school? Do I do it virtually or hybrid? I have many friends who, you know, are dating or trying to meet somebody. And I had a friend text me the other day saying something like, well, I'm going to meet up with him. But to get to that point, it was like a UN negotiation. Right? Where have you been?
Right.
How have you been quarantining? What do you assume? Do you actually maintain 6 feet of distance? You know, whatever. And both of them basically, because the, you know, they had to have an extremely explicit conversation that one that you normally wouldn't have to have on a first date. And that's and yet we're kind of each doing that with every single social interaction we have. Well, I would say those who have higher those who want to maintain social distance and maintain relative amounts of quarantine, the weight is then put on them to then basically like check every single interaction you may want to have if it's physical, and it's exhausting.
Right. When people have such different needs, how do we get to the point where we can understand what the other person needs, even if we know going in, I can't give that to you?
Well, the good news is, even though this feels new, most family systems have difference within them. And our entire life has been navigating boundaries with those we love, right?
Yeah.
and whether that's in some families, whether alcohol will be present or not, and whether, you know, and deciding whether to engage or not. For some families, it might mean if a new in-law has entered the family and one side is particularly religious and the other side isn't, do you use the word God at the table? Do you pray even if everybody at the table doesn't believe it, you know, in God or in the same God? Like,
yeah.
Fortunately, it's a myth to say that this is new. This version is perhaps new. This version is more extreme. But part of the way that one has always dealt with this, at least in conflict resolution, is to ask a set of questions. The first is, what is it that I need, and who is my immediate circle of responsibility? For some people, it may be your mother. For you, it may be a partner or a child. But who is my immediate first circle of responsibility? And not everybody is equal, right? We are not each responsible to 1,000 people. Well, who is my first level of responsibility? And then have the first conversation within that circle. What is it that we need this year? And what are our non-negotiables? And then once everybody's agreed, say, okay, if an invitation comes in, if we want to come together as a holiday, how do we have a conversation with whoever else is out there to see if we can do that? And then the second is, what does responsibility look like this year? So with your example, if your mother is saying, I need to see your face, you know, one of the reasons I launched Together Apart, this podcast with the New York Times, is because I actually think finding ways to make virtual gatherings meaningful, hilarious, powerful is a public safety issue. Like, I think Together Apart is actually,
right?
It should be categorized as a public health podcast. Because part of what we're doing is we're mourning the loss of meaningful time with other people. And we can, and so rather than canceling things, part of, I think, the opportunity to actually, rather than like policing people saying, don't go out and don't, you know, physically distance, replace their idea with a different idea that still allows for meaningful connection. So with your mother, and I don't know her, it might be if she loves music, it might be getting her to, what if you did a listening session for an hour and a half where you played on Spotify all of your favorite songs from her childhood? And she's like, wow, how did you get all those? This is really neat. I actually really felt like I was with you. Like, but yeah. It creates, one is you need to, we all each need to ask, what is the need here? And then two, what are the tools we have to meaningfully come together safely, and I would say virtually or social distance wise, so that we can actually still feel like, you know, these are people I want to spend time with.
What do we know about rituals that matter and that have meaning for human beings that we can apply to some of the things that we're facing in the next 30 days, for example?
So meaningful rituals tend to be specific. I'll give an example. It's the difference between everybody coming, sitting in front of your Zoom window, or even coming to a party and bringing a beer, versus saying, the only beer that's allowed is a Coors Light. Everybody at 7:23 p.m., I don't care if you like Coors Light or hate it, we're doing Coors Light or Lagunitas IPA, like whatever, it doesn't really matter. But that we, I actually learned this in improv as well, like the difference between stepping out, like jumping out into the floor, into the stage and saying like, I'm having an ice cream. I remember the teacher was like, cut. What kind of ice cream? Add specificity. And the person like did the scene again and was pretending to lick an ice cream cone. And she said, I'm having, this mango ice cream cone is delicious. And everyone started laughing, and we weren't really sure why we were laughing, but there was this meaning that lied in specificity. So how does that apply to our rituals right now? So if you're thinking about gathering people, gathering, figure out your need, but then make whatever the actual act is specific. So it could be a very specific time. Like many of us, like if it's someone's birthday or if it's New Year's, like what time is someone born? If they were born at 9:47 a.m., what if you actually like gather for mimosas and almonds? Again, I'm making it up. Everyone's going to have mimosas and almonds at 9:48 a.m. to honor the moment Sandy was born and her favorite foods. I'll give another example. I think there are ways we can do this virtually, but I think there's also ways we can still gather physically, you know, outside that are safe. I have in the Art of Gathering, part of what I did was I interviewed over 100 types of gatherers all over the world who were credited by other people for creating meaningful, powerful, memorable experiences. And one of them is a woman named Ida Benedetto. And I called her up recently, and I was just curious. She creates magical experiences professionally and personally for people. I said, well, how are you thinking about the holidays? And she said, well, I think that it's important to move away from the word party right now and to think instead in terms of adventure. And I said, what do you mean by that? And she said, the difference between a party and an adventure is that an adventure has two things, a mission and motion. And I was like, okay, what do you mean? And she said, well, for my 30th birthday, I had a friend who was a photographer, and he had this little kind of photo project in which he went around the city and took photos of like keyholes. And so for my birthday, I invited 12 friends to bring their cameras or their iPhones or their phones with the camera on it for 2 hours and to roam the bars in our town and to outside and just to take photos of the most beautiful keyholes they could find. And she said years later, to my kind of surprise, many of my friends talk about my 30th birthday as like one of the most memorable, fun nights in their life. And to me, it was like, it's not that complicated, but we had a shared mission and we had motion. And once it's getting cold in a lot of places, you know, motion outside, moving through your town or your city with a specific mission that's related to something that you care about is actually a wonderfully creative way of spending time together, but also giving people a sense of, you know, forward motion, team, like team bondedness. And it can be about anything, but it should be specific. Keyholes, yeah. Right? Green tinsel. It doesn't actually really matter, but whatever it is, like powerful ritual and experiences lie in specificity.
And now even a little more hope. The first doses of a coronavirus vaccine are scheduled to be available for South Dakota healthcare workers by mid-December. It's an important first step towards saving thousands of lives. In a state where the science of mask wearing has been so misunderstood, clear communication about how vaccines work, why they're important, is vital. Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health. He helped us understand the new vaccine in this explainer. Vaccines save lives by teaching the human body to fight off a virus it hasn't encountered yet. Smallpox, polio, measles, and soon the virus that causes COVID-19. So imagine a microscopic ball with spikes. By now you've seen illustrations of what the coronavirus looks like. Here's Dr. Shankar Kura explaining how that virus does its destructive work inside the body.
That's why it's called a coronavirus. It looks like this solar corona with spikes emanating around the sphere. And those spikes are the way this virus attaches to the human cell, and that's how it gets access into the cell. And then once it gets in, it replicates, and that's an invaded cell. Now you're infected, and then unfortunately all the bad things happen.
In this case, those bad things include everything from a mild cough to a life-threatening loss of the ability to breathe. Thousands of South Dakotans have been infected, thousands have recovered, but more than 800 South Dakotans have also died from COVID-19. With hospitals across the state struggling to meet the new surge in infected and critically ill patients, that death toll will continue to rise. Since the moment the virus was first discovered, scientists and governments around the world have been pouring billions of dollars into the development of a safe and effective vaccine. The vaccines closest to approval are the first of their kind because instead of using a weakened or inactive version of the virus to teach the immune system how to respond, they use a blueprint of sorts. You don't need to understand how that works, but if you want to, first it helps to understand a little something about RNA. Here's Dr. Kura.
It's what's called a messenger RNA. So the basic building block, the code for all life, is in DNA, which most of us recognize, deoxyribonucleic acid. For viruses, quite a few of them have RNA, which is just a single strand. Think of it as a DNA, but with one strand missing. And what this vaccine does is takes a snippet of an RNA, which is called a messenger, because it carries the message to make a specific protein, in this case, the spike protein.
And that brings us back to that ball with spikes that we talked about before.
What the vaccine does is very clever. It takes just a snippet that can code for that protein, not the whole virus, just that spike protein. So when you inject this messenger RNA vaccine into shoulder muscle there, like you would get intramuscular injection, the RNA is then taken in by the cell, and then it's the cell's own machinery reads that code and makes that specific spike protein. Once it does so, the human immune system automatically goes into action. It recognizes that as alien and builds antibodies specifically targeted against the spike protein. And so once that's accomplished, the person who received the vaccine, then when they encounter or get infected, the virus is unable to attach to the human cell because it's blocked by the specific antibodies that our immune system produces.
South Dakotans quite reasonably want to know, does this vaccine work and is it safe?
So this has been very successful in animal trials. So that's preclinical trials. Then phase one and phase two trials clearly showed that this is a very safe vaccine. That's what phase one's intention is. This current phase three trial is looking at 40,000 participants in each of these two messenger RNA vaccines, both the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. They're both similar. And what these studies have shown is of the 40,000 volunteers, half of them received the vaccine, half did not. And in both and all of those folks who received the vaccine, it gave them 90 to 95% protection against getting the disease when they were exposed to it. And secondly, they're also safe. It does not cause any harm to the individuals concerned.
A genetic code makes a protein, which means the patient can't actually contract anything from the vaccine itself. It's precise and targeted protection with the potential to not only fight COVID-19, but to revolutionize the way we think about vaccination development in the future. On In the Moment, we believe that quality conversations have the power to help us understand who we are, create a stronger democracy, and build a more vibrant future for all of us. So, keep talking, South Dakota. Better yet, keep listening to one another. Whether you're sharing your concerns about COVID, your memories of a joyous holidays past, or if you're just trying to figure out what comes next, the questions are often more important than declarations of opinion. Keep asking, keep listening. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. The In the Moment team includes Steve Zwemke, Chris Loffrey, and me. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.